here to talk about right now is, I know we had a question about which tool when, I know we had a question about security, but I also wanted to talk about just how do you keep on top of the work, the stuff that's coming down the pipe. And there's really about five different ways, and I'm going to ask you guys to just flip around here real quick. The most important place to start is fasttrack.com, fasttrack.microsoft.com/roadmap. This really came out of the way that, actually this came over from a Yammer bit, when Yammer was acquired. They worked very wide in the open and published everything that was out there in process, and sometimes even things that were rejected. So they would do A/B testing, which is they test a new feature on a small set of customers and another set on the other customers, and had the testing and saw what the adoption was around that. And so that's your primary resource. You can even filter it down by product name and get into depth there. And you can see what was released, and they'll have details around it. There's also a great site. Also, if you're going to be managing Office 365 in any one way, go to WAC Manage, same site, /manage. That's where I'm going to be pulling the sway from actually today. So I'm going to be presenting the sway shortly around how to prepare for the changes that are in your environment. The next one is the Office blogs. We go into really in-depth about what's going on. A lot of times the roadmap will actually reflect something that's been mentioned in the blogs. But sometimes it might also mention a TechNet article.
I was going to add something that's just started to develop as an enhancement to Office blogs. So I was going to scribble one additional point.
Yeah.
Is, you know, Michael mentioned the tech community. So I'll just put MSTC. Is that what? Huh? MSTC, is that the acronym you had? So the Microsoft tech community. What started happening in about like late December 2016 is a bunch of the program managers in Office 365 got together and they recognize that there's some friction with the publishing process for Office blogs, that they can't get the announcement information out fast enough on Office blogs. So they're going to keep using that vehicle, but it's going to be kind of more of a summary, kind of here's everything that happened in the last month. If you want more kind of real-time announcement information, there are blogs now for each service area inside the tech community. So if you go into the tech community and go to SharePoint, the information about the OneDrive that Michael talked about, that started trickling out in mid-December before the January release in the blogs that are there. So Skype for Business, Exchange, Office Client, that each one of those product groups there all started doing that. And so kind of think of it as the farm system or the feeder to the Office blog system.
Yeah, that's a great point, because those Office blogs are really in-depth, but there's a lot of work that goes into publishing one of those. So those are all publicly available resources there. The next, as we get a little bit deeper here, you have to have additional rights, let's just say. So Office 365 admins have access to the message center. And that is a very important place for admins to look at the changes that are coming down the pike. And you can even filter it by whether it's just informational or if there's an action required. For example, that OneDrive Sync client update is really, there's an action required on your part to be aware of this change that's coming down the pipe. And then last one is, there's NDA information that we do have and we do share with our customers, as long as you send a mutual NDA with your account team. And even your if you have a technical account manager in your account, they can and should be sending you out regular updates around what's coming. And it's also an opportunity to get involved with some of the early products that are out there too. For example, we just had Teams that was released. And for a while that was being called Skype Teams internally. And that was NDA, but we had our some customers early on engaged there. And now, obviously, the NDA wrappers have been lifted, and it's available to all of you guys. So if you really want to get on some of the early bits around that, work with your technical account manager and or account team to work on that. So that
I'm going to add to that.
Yeah.
The Office Services MVPs and Office Development MVPs get a monthly roadmap update that is, it's NDA, so it can't tell you specific things, but it should certainly help you guide you in the right direction.
Yeah.
And if you're interested in getting to know more about product or need some contact with Microsoft, MVPs can facilitate that.
Good point. That's a really good point. So that's kind of your high level. So this is really, this SWAY is really targeted to people that are managing it, both from a, more from an IT perspective, but I think what we're trying to do is coach our customers that from an IT management point of view, you need to be change managers. So that's really where this SWAY is helpful. So here's some of the videos that are available, and I don't want to drain these yourself. You can look at them yourself. So it really kind of reminds you what your role as a change manager is and what Microsoft's role is here. So you have to be aware of what's coming, what's available to you, and then managing that change yourself, right? And so there, it's really kind of a full cycle of processes here. Microsoft has our expectations that we're going to be setting for you, and then there's change that we plan, and there's also change that we don't plan. And that's service incidents, right? And so we do our best. Obviously, no cloud services is 100% perfect. We just realized that right now with the fast track site being down right now. So we do our best to communicate with you around when a service incident is happening and what actions need to be taken by you. There again, additional details around how we roll out change and some of the communications that are available to you. Some of the information that was already shared there is in the office blogs. We have a bunch of video sites are out there, the Cloud Roadshow, Chat 9. How to prepare for a service incident. It's really important to have kind of a playbook, almost like a tornado drill, the binder of information that you're going to pull out and be prepared for a service incident. I was listening on the way in today, and they were talking about how the CDC is updating their protocols for how we handle quarantining individuals. And what it was a response to the Ebola situation where people were coming over, and we didn't know if we had the rights to actually hold people or not. And what I heard today on that news story was we're trying to manage change in the future. Instead of having to scramble about, oh my gosh, Ebola is coming to this country, and having to make the decisions at the moment, having a little bit more foresight about what we're going to do going forward when something really does happen is really important here. And so having that playbook is really important. And again, we have some materials here for you that you can look through here. Having stakeholders involved here is really important. It's not just an IT initiative. It is a matter of having all the different relevant people that are engaged there. So security is really important to have, internal communications, HR, and the individual lines of business that are running your lines of business should be engaged here with your stakeholder plan here. And we have some samples. We have sample plans for you. This downloadable is a Word doc you can go and edit and tweak yourself. So this is kind of what I posted on the back wall there. What are your channels that are out there? So roadmap.office.com, that'll point also to that same link that I have back there. The message center, if you're an admin, you really need to be paying attention to that and being on top of the information that's out there. And checking out the blog, the roadmap, technical community, really important to have out there. Understanding how that impacts the different organizations in your organization. And then also, I do want to call out that, yeah, in the message center, there is the ability to provide feedback back to the product team. They'll look at that and bring that, incorporate that into changes that are happening there. And then this is a quick hit for when there is a service incident, when you're missing availability inside of there. Here's some additional resources around service management. I don't want to take a kill this. And here's some additional links at the bottom here. So that this Office 365 network will redirect you back to the tech community. So that is high level how to address the managing the change within your organization. There's also a security center, also I want to call it, Larry, that's available that has similar information but more security focused around, instead of just message center around managing change, there's also a security center that is available to you guys out there. Cool. Any questions or thoughts? Please beg, borrow, and steal this stuff.
I'm excited to steal some of that stuff.
Yeah.
We get the link.
We'll post this. Jump back to where the quads were for the two goals.
Microsoft versus
incident here, these two. Yeah, so these two. So this slide talks about your role as an admin. I just want to kind of relay a kind of current scenario I'm going through with a customer that I support. This is a large global organization. This information is accurate and applies, equally well across the whole spectrum of customer sizes, from 100 seats all the way up to 100,000 seats. The difference is in terms of how you will structure a team to enact what's the guidance that's here. So that's what I wanted to drill down a little bit, since we've got some time to talk about it. So this is kind of a simplified, generic view of things that Microsoft is offering to all customers. But I guess the point that I want to make is you're going to have to internalize it and incorporate it into your corporate structure and your existing business processes, right? So if you're a multinational corporation with 100,000 people, you probably have a very large, extensive help desk, right? You might even have delegated IT leads or practice area leads in different geographies, and so on and so forth. So those folks are going to have some vested interest or need to participate in the bullet items that are on this slide. But you're going to have to think about how you're going to organize your organization to provide that level of interaction and fluidity of information. So admittedly, Office 365 has some constraints in terms of where the information is at and how you access it. So Peter talked about before that, when you get down to that item number 4, the message center, that's an admin-only experience. It's secured. So not every Office 365 user can get in there. You have to have certain different elevated rights. So I don't want to get too technical, but most of you folks here probably are involved enough to understand what the global administrator is within Office 365, right? That person has access to the message center. And then there are a few more granular roles that we've provided. One of them is a service administrator. That person also has rights to get to see the message center, right? So what you want to think about in a large organization is, where do you need to apply and assign that delegated access? And then along with the access goes responsibilities, right? So this is something that I'm working through with my customer right now, is who will be the person whose job it is to review and triage the information that is being pushed out in the message center, right? Somebody has to be responsible, and it may be a group of somebodies, right? Because the impact might be different in different geographies or in different lines of business within a large global organization. So Skype for Business, as an example, in my customer, they're focusing on a rollout in North America first. So there's a set of technology leaders and business stakeholders in the United States who would react much differently to a message center event with required action for Skype for Business than would those same roles, but in EMEA or Asia, because it doesn't really impact them yet, right? But in order to have the change control process set up, you have to assign somebody in those other geographies and, you know, get them trained in understanding how to triage these things, and then they have a network that they have to filter that information down to, right? So if we come out and we say, you know, we're going to roll out an upgrade to the Skype for Business client that will add this new capability, well, you know, they should have an action plan that says, okay, end user facing change, devise a training plan, devise a communication plan, so on and so forth, right? So that's just the kind of the key point that I want to make, is that this is a highly general guidance. You need to personalize it to your organization. And I could say all the same things about this is the change quadrant, right? Say all the same things about the incident quadrant.
So a couple things. One of the things that we did in our environment, we actually have two tenants, one that we set up as a first release. But even before we did that, we set some users up as a first release.
Yeah.
So they can see and start to vet out.
That is great.
Some of the changes. Now they have to be careful because, like, when Planner first came out, it didn't work quite right because the tenant wasn't the first release. So while the users could see it and do some things, not it wasn't fully functional.
Yeah.
The other thing to be aware of, and this is something that I need to talk to Larry and you about, is when they roll out some of these new features, by default, they turn them on, license them for everybody.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, they talked about at some point where we can make a request that when they roll out new features, to roll them out on license so that it gives us a chance to determine how and when we want to release that, how, when, and if we want to release that. Because, again, sometimes you don't get a lot of time between the message center.
Let me speak to that real quick. That has been very consistent feedback that many customers have given to Microsoft. So Microsoft is a large organization. There are a lot of ears that need to hear that. A few of them have gotten the message. So when Teams came out, it was not that way.
Okay.
So the bad old days, let's talk about Planner, right? Planner came out, it was licensed for everybody and turned on for everybody, and you had to opt out of it. It freaked everybody out. Everybody's confused with his Planner. And so that's where we started to get a lot of that feedback. And then Teams, though, went the opposite direction. So Teams was pushed out. There was a lot of advance notice. It was off by default. You have to turn it on to let people access the functionality. Now, I don't want to say problem solved. I want all of you to keep your guard up and to keep giving the feedback to Microsoft, because there are a lot of different internal development project teams. And we're trying to get them all to align, but I've worked at Microsoft 16 years now. I'm telling you that some rogue entity within the organization is going to push out a change that should have been opt-in, and it's going to be pushed out as opt-out. So I'll apologize ahead of time, but we're trying.
I wanted to know. Okay. I know. Right? So as far as the test tenant and having like the production tenant, that's something that I'm going through right now, trying to understand what the best practice is. And that was one of our suggestions, was to set up the test tenant with the first release.
Yeah.
And then I think I heard at the tech summit that is the standard that after it's in there for 30 days, it automatically goes to like your production tenant?
A test tenant is a separate entity. It's not, it has no relationship to the production tenant. Okay. And it's an optional thing that you may or may not have. And I see customers handle it in two different situations. The one is they want a stable, reliable, always there test tenant. And for that scenario, it's a little complicated from a licensing standpoint, but you have to pay for the subscriptions in that tenant to keep it alive. Okay. The other way that you could do it, and for a small organization, I would, you know, highly encourage you to have no trouble doing this, is just create a trial tenant. Trial tenant will last for 30 days, and then the trial expires, and then you kind of have to treat it like Kleenex, throw it away, get another one the next time. But for a small organization, that might be adequate, right? So, yeah. So you don't have to incur the extra cost. So. But now, either way, whether it was a trial or a paid test tenant, there's no relationship or nothing flows between the two. When Microsoft deploys a new piece of functionality, it would be available in the first release settings of both your production and your test. But what's being suggested here is you would turn on first release for the whole test tenant and for all or most of the 25 or less users that are in the test tenant so that they could kick the tires and see it. And over in the production tenant, you would never turn first release on for the whole tenant. You might turn first release on for small groups of users in the production tenant. Does that make sense? Any questions on it?
Taking that a step further.
Yeah.
When does it get released to the masses? After, and is that just turning it? I know some are turning on and some are just.
Yeah. So how long does something stay in the first release?
Yes.
And versus when does it move to full production? There's no hard and fast rule. Different development teams have moved at different speeds. I've typically seen it never be less than a month, but sometimes it could be longer, maybe 3 or 4 months. It's usually quality driven.
Microsoft, when we first started this, and we have actually two paid tenants, all right? We took like 200 of our licenses from our production tenant and we had them moved over. So we're not paying more because it's less users. So we just have, we have it as separate AD and the whole bit. So, but what they told us is that generally once it comes out in first release, they figure about 3 weeks to a month before they'll start to roll it out. And I think Larry has explained this before, the way Microsoft rolls out features to non-first release tenants is they basically put the code out there on all their servers and slowly activate it on servers. So we've actually had times where we've had some people who have gotten the new features or seen the new look like in SharePoint, and an hour later or a day later, they don't see it because they hit a different server that hadn't been updated yet. So, but I've heard stories where it's taken as much as like 6 months to a year, and I've heard stories where it's shown up literally in 3 to 4 weeks after. Is that once you see it in your first release, you start your change process, you have to be ready to go at a moment's notice because there is no guarantee or indication. You're going to wake up one morning and somebody's going to say, oh, planner's here. Right, and you're going to have to be ready, like kind of like a SWAT team, say, okay, we've already vetted this out, this is how we're going to do it, we have all the communications, we have the lights, right, we're ready. As soon as you see it, hit the button and do that.
No dates on the roadmap.
Yeah.
Is it? The dates
on the roadmap?
No. No. Sometimes the first release, you'll get the needs, but not the production.
Right. Okay. Sometimes in Message Center, they will say, we start rollout on this date. But you never know when it's going to hit.
Generally, they'll tell you when it's going to start.
Down this way, things are getting more specific. So many times with Message Center, like Mike was saying, we can tell you the start, but we can't tell you the finish. To the bridge's point is we have hundreds of servers in hundreds of data centers at this point, right? So it takes time for those changes to deploy. So it's hard to get gauge when it's going to finish rolling out. So Message Center usually talks about we'll start rolling out, and they try to give a range. It's like it should be done within a month or 2 months or 3 months. Like it's a longer time. They're generally better at communicating that it's going to be over a long period of time.
I think it's generally gotten towards coming out faster. We don't see as much of the disparity between users lately.
It really depends on the change, right? Not all changes are created equal, right? Like the SharePoint change that Rich talked about, that was highly dependent on the individual server that you were hitting. Other changes like focused inbox is one where I saw the rollout behavior be completely different. It was more like they got all the Exchange servers upgraded, and then they flipped the switch at the kind of the end of that process, and everybody saw it in their Outlook on the same day. So it's definitely going to vary depending on what the nature of the change is. And that's where your admin, I don't like that term because admin's a little too general. For this quadrant, I would call that your service change manager. They're going to gain experience over time in how to read the tea leaves of how the message center messages are written, and in playing around in first release. They're going to know when they hear about a new feature to go look to see if there's an on-off switch for it. They're going to know to try and figure out if it's the type of feature that can be assigned on a per user or a per tenant basis, right? There's kind of all these different dimensions, and each change can vary along those dimensions.
One thing I've noticed is really helpful. People like Michael and Larry and Peter and people from Microsoft, when something new shows up, there's a lot of chatter about it. So if you see on the Met Center that something new is coming up, Google it. I seriously mean that, because literally by the time you see it, they already know about it. I don't know how they do it, but Michael was saying he gets advanced notice of these things. So they've already looked at this stuff. They've already tested it. So that's been a real big help for us when we see these things in the Message Center, going out and Googling and starting to read some of the blogs. And as I said, then we get our people together and we say, okay, what do we need to do to be ready for this if we're going to be ready? Either we have to be ready to turn it off if we're not, don't think we'll be ready to roll out, or do we need to commute? Is this big enough that we need to communicate it to the user? We'll pre-draft those communications and have them ready to go. Do we need to get, security sign-off? Is this something, like a focused inbox, not a big deal. We didn't even bother with that, right? Unless somebody called up. The new look in SharePoint, again, not a security concern, but certainly we had to have a communication.
So there's something you just touched on that I want to talk about. And you said that there was a change, you decided, a focused inbox, you decided you didn't need to do anything about it. So how many changes were there in last year, 2016, for Office 365? And yeah, there's a number I heard was basically over 300. So on average, something new is happening every day. Now if you look at this, one of the things it says is, update any user and help desk content. Well, that is fine in principle, and that works for when you've got product rollouts that change every 3 years like they used to. But when you've got new changes happening every day, there's two things you need to think about. One is, when you're moving from the model of product update every 3 years, where in 3 years you had big changes, to product updates every day, each change, most of them can be tiny. Things like focused inbox, you need to decide whether or not you want to bother updating your documentation, updating any user communication, or realizing that that's small enough, users will just figure it out. So that's one of the sort of changes in mindset that you need to think through as you plan for change. Go ahead.
To that point, when they release the changes, are they highlighted somehow to say what a big change is versus a small change? Like, for example, a new product is released. Is that highlighted somewhere like, hey, new product?
In Message Center, did you say informational?
That's a good question. So I got that one from my customer, too. And here, I'll move on. What I was going to say is, changes in the eye of the beholder. Right? So what's a small change to you might be a big change to somebody else, right? Because it may be focused inbox, small change to you because of the way you manage and triage your mail, big change to somebody else who's, more on the compulsive disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder. They don't want people to move their stuff around. They don't like that there's just automatic filtering that's happening. So, it's really going to depend. But to kind of zoom it out a little bit, security, I heard that, right? That's going to be one of your largest determining factors between large and small. Again, it's going to vary organization to organization. But that's what I would, that's one of the first things I would look at. Does the change introduce a new storage location for data? Do we have to worry about doing data retention or e-discovery over this new storage location? Does it enable sharing of data or information that previously was somehow protected or restricted in the organization? So the external sharing features that we've been lighting up, especially for the 365 groups, that you can now turn on a switch to allow a group owner to invite external users to a group, right? So it's a small change from our perspective. We put a switch there. But it's a huge change from a policy
right.
security standpoint.
And that's kind of where we're struggling, because there's security in, like, our IT side of the house, but then there's business decisions that need to be made around those changes. So,
right.
Like, this admin role, for example, a lot of these things I feel like kind of falls under, like, my business hat more
yeah.
than the tech hat,
yes.
but
yes.
I don't have the admin right, so I got to go back and say, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Like, I
yeah.
feel like this is something that I
yeah,
need
so
to do.
Yeah, so there are some constrained
yeah,
roles
to,
that you can delegate, yeah.
Does Microsoft have anything like that that shows, like, the roles when it comes to the admin, like, what type of
yeah, there's
business
actually,
side versus
there's
technology?
There's some granularity that you can.
Right.
Yeah,
that's what I'm trying to
there's documentation on TechNet for that yeah. tells you all the roles, and it's like a matrix grid, and it shows
yeah.
what they have access
that's there?
To.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
What strikes me as missing is a role that is just read-only access to the message center.
That's a good one.
I know, it's
yeah.
I kinda,
that's kind of what I would like.
The
exactly.
service administrator, but they have... Let me start out by agreeing with you. Granularity is not a...
It used to be, we even used to have it completely publicly available.
Yeah, and the thing that we don't have is user configurable permissions. It's like, you get an option of like five different roles, and we say what permissions those roles have. But a lot of times, especially the larger the organization and the way responsibility is delegated throughout the organization, is you really want to create your own custom role that has a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and we don't have that flexibility yet in the product.
I want to add a counterpoint to something that was discussed earlier, but I want to roll this out to a certain amount of users. Consider the use case of what you're trying to roll out and why you're doing that. So is it a matter of I want to get a hold of it so I can write my own change management documentation? That makes a lot of sense from a change management point of view. But if it's a matter of, I'm not ready to really roll this thing out completely wide across my company, like, for example, Teams, and so I'm only going to roll it out to these certain groups and these certain groups, it's kind of difficult to do, especially based upon the use case you might be trying to get to, right? If you're trying to have, say, a team or even groups might be a better example of this, where you want to have a public group where you want to have people collaborating across the organization, that's going to be really difficult to do. So my recommendation in some of those is actually to maybe have a very small group that gets the individual change early on. We talk about having a small set
pilot.
Of users. Yeah, small pilot group. But don't do these rolling pilots, especially on big collaboration changes, because you might not start realizing the business value out of it until you roll it out and you cross the
business. Yeah, a lot of these features, they only become valuable through what's called the network effect, right? You have to have enough people using the feature in order for it to be valuable. Delve is a lot. Right?
Yeah. And then I think one of the nice things about Planner is it's really meant to go across functional teams, right?
Yeah.
As groups, it's too. But right. So if I start to, if I'm working on a project with somebody on a different team, and they're not part of that pilot, I can assign them a task. But how did I get to it? So, you know, Planner is what we kind of did for and again, to exactly to your case, we did things like that in small groups for testing, determining use cases, learning what the things that, you know, in some cases, like anything, software developers, sometimes when they roll it out initially, there's not a lot of features or not a lot of administrative controls. Groups, for example, when we first started, groups had no administrative controls. Basically the Wild West. Over the last 6 months, there's been some really good controls, and we're starting to determine how we can roll this out to the enterprise, even though we've had a small group of people playing with it.
After you roll it out, though, you might think that you're going to be doing some initial stuff from an IT point of view, from an IT lens. You have to iterate on that and get the feedback from the users, because they're going to. You might not think it's really cool, but the individual users might, and so bringing that around.
Exactly. We generally have a business that's not all IT. We have, you know, our support team, because we have to support it, and then we usually bring in one of the business groups that we think would be a great candidate. So that they're giving us, just to your point, we don't keep it in IT. We keep it in IT and at least one business group to do that we think it's appropriate for to start with.
Yeah, I wanted to say on that point of view on the control and about teams, for example. I think the whole point of teams is to be, you have those groups for teams that they basically initially started by the business, by people in the business, and be able to very quickly get self-provision a space. Right.
Yeah.
So on the flip side of that, I think that what's missing now, and that's apparently being worked on for GA, is more administrative controls and admin panel, because we need to help the janitors to be able to mop up after all those teams are created and abandoned. Right?
Yeah.
So I think that's a really good point. I mean, this group is about adoption. If you're an IT person, we've got a lot of IT people here. We can roll out anything you want, but until the business, until the business decides to do business, it doesn't matter what we put out. I mean, I think that's a big lesson that we're learning over the last couple of years, not just with Office 365, but especially as we're getting younger people into our workforce, they know what they want, and they're going to tell us in IT, you know, and they're going to tell you as the business leaders what you're supposed to ask us for. So I think I think that's why you do definitely need the business as part of your pilot.
I'm get real tactical here, but did you actually build that pilot in the test tenant or in like your production for just the users?
We generally will use our test tenant. We have very few business people in our test tenant because we do a lot of strange things, yes. So usually we'll use the first release to vet out the technical parts of it and the security parts of it.
In production,
right? Because first of all, understand that our test tenant and our production tenant are full, from Microsoft's perspective, they're full functional tenants, right? They do everything the same based on the licensing. It's just how we use it. So once we've decided that we've got the security risks figured out in the IT, once it comes to our production tenant, we generally will leave it off and then bring it to a certain business group and say, look, we know you've been asking about this. We want you to be the first people to try it and work with us.
Right.
Once we've got the business cases worked out, make sure it's functional, then we can start to figure out how to roll it out to the rest of the company.
So when you're trying to think that role is falling into my role, so when you're figuring out your business case and stuff like that before you're going to the business, so
right.
I may be representing and going out to the business, but I need to be in the lead to understand.
Right, and we have some. We have a couple of our architects.
Yeah,
business architects in there too.
Is that still considered like one of those few people in the test? Center?
Sure.
Yeah.
That's and, what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, so the test. Yeah, the test.
Larry said it best. Every company's a little different. So if you, it's really your company.
Yeah.
That's
The thing about test though, it's completely separate, right? So if I'm in the test tenant, I'm not getting my production email. I'm not getting anything production. It's just all.
So for a business user, it's not
a true end business
user. Right.
A true end business user who you need to participate in a pilot. They can't be productive in the test.
Correct. This is more proof of concept.
Yeah, the test tenant, I like it. I don't know why, for some reason, I like the term kick the tires. That's the only thing that happens in the test tenant. It's for the technical guys to get in there and, like, you know, what happens if I unplug this? What happens if I do that? What happens if it is? It's for them to kind of really get familiar before. Well, so technical guys and gals, maybe I'd say, like, expand the definition of technical, I guess, because there is somebody in this process who is trying to think about user content, right? They can go in there and kick the tires, but you're not going to run a pilot because you're not going to have business screenshots.
We consider it a proof of concept.
Yeah, so you figure out the terminology that works.
Right. Whoever supports that.
Right, and then we always try to bring in an architect or a business leader from that, where we think it might go, to say, yes, this makes sense, this is a good group, or no, we really don't need this function. I'll check with somebody else. So
Yeah, that's my conversation tomorrow. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
I want to come back to one thought that I had when Peter was talking about the cycle and the iteration and so forth. In this bullet, which I pointed to already, about user content and help desk content, my guidance to customers would be this, is avoid manufacturing your own user content as much as possible.
Put an asterisk.
Is help desk content, I'm all for it, because help desk content, that's where you're empowering your help desk professionals to be productive and efficient and get your business user back to work. So you have to anticipate and understand the questions that are going to be very kind of like context specific within your organization and how to map those. But the user content, Microsoft is it's always invested a lot of money, and we're continuing to invest a lot of money in training materials that you can just link to, right? So there's training.office.com, there's the Microsoft Virtual Academy, there's all kinds of, I mean, there's tons of stuff that we push out there. And the more that users are using a, I would say, a consistent user interface experience, the less need there is for you to develop custom content, right? Like in the old days, rewind to Moss 2007, for instance, as an example, I'll call that the old days. What I used to see all the time is people were okay using off-the-shelf Word training materials because Word was Word was Word no matter where you went, but they were not okay using off-the-shelf SharePoint training materials because back in the 2007 days, the first thing every organization was doing was rebranding it. How do I make it not look like SharePoint? And they're changing everything, so the generic training materials were not useful. Well, we're seeing less and less of that now in SharePoint, Skype, OneDrive. It's much more consistent across all.
Think about how do you update training for a
I mean, you get called, what the heck is Focus Inbox? Oh, here's a link. Right, and that's the kind of content you want to make sure.
That user, what we'll generally do, we'll use the Microsoft, and then we'll put like a text file for something different. Like, remember, in our environment, you have to do X, Y, and Z to do that. So
state the exception.
We don't generally try to change it unless it's something completely different. We generally put a little text document with it.
So even though these documents are here now, I'm almost cautioning, like, you know, there might be documents here that are available. Don't bring them in and rebrand them just to rebrand them for the sake of rebranding. You know, like, we have these documents that are out there that will help out with some of your communication plans out here, but to Larry's point, use as much of the information that's out there as possible.
I think word is word.
No, how many people
talk to use Word in general?
Yeah. We brought up like a couple things already here also I want to cover off on. So which tool went and security, I know those were at the start up there. So from which tool went point of view, I know this comes up all the time, but one of the things that we've noticed, especially with Teams, as you guys have mentioned, is that people just kind of find ways to do it, to use it. And there's another question of, do you even need to clean this stuff up, right? I guess that's the if you're a person that has a lot of automated messages in your inbox, it's like it doesn't freak you out, that you're going to be fine with leaving some of the old things out there. But there is some validity to a lot of this cleanup, quote unquote, doesn't necessarily need to happen from a community point of view. If the community isn't there in the first place, it doesn't really matter. It's not like you're going to be charged for storage for this thing or anything like that. So I think that we kind of look at it from our previous on-premises point of view, but I think there's a lot of things that we can just kind of let it be in a lot of ways here. And then from a security point of view, how do you, maybe I'll leave this as an open question, how do you guys manage change to Office as it relates to security? Or do you at all? You said you do engage security.
Well, they're running it right now, so that's okay. What I'm trying to go in and say, well, hold on a second, because I'm not looking at it from a business lens. So that's kind of what I'm trying to work on, because we also have like a CASB in place where we have a
we're working with another third-party provider right now. Yeah. And so just trying to make sure that our use cases work with our current security structure is a challenge.
What we're talking about when we talk about click-to-run versus MSIL. Okay, let me define that term, because it's important, and I have a little bit of passion around this topic. In the olden days, in 2007, we'll call that the olden days again, right, the only way that you ever installed Office on your computer was a bare, hard metal install, and the installer, the tool, used a file that was called an MSI, a Microsoft installer file. So that's turned into shorthand jargon for install the bits on the computer. It puts stuff in the registry, it puts stuff on the file system, it's hardwired on them, and it's kind of the very traditional way of installing Office client software, so Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Outlook. That's what we're talking about. Click to run takes advantage of what's called application virtualization technology. It still puts the bits on the computer, the local workstation. To the end user, it still runs the same way. They double click to launch and they have their copy of Word there. But it's a little bit more isolated from the operating system underneath.
Okay. Think about your phone, for example. Like the way those
yeah, the apps that you install from the app store on your phone. Yeah, it's more consistent with that kind of a installation model. So now with Office 365, the subscription entitles you to a click-to-run installed version of the Office clients, okay? And that's the model that Microsoft would encourage you to select. And the reason why is, precisely I think the reason it's a little bit of a point of concern, is that Microsoft manages the client as a service and in conjunction with all of the back-end server services. Right? So every month, for a click-to-run user, they can get an update to their client install, and we push that update. In the default configuration, we push that update to the machine, but in a more complex organization, the configuration management function of an enterprise could control in the update of those click-to-run bits. Now, the point where the end user starts to care again is functionality or capability. We did release Office 2016 with an MSI installation. That was a snapshot, if you will, a point in time of the Office client products back in, I think it was October of 2015 is when we started that. Since that time, the service has added new features and capabilities. Some of those features require the client to be updated in order to work. The MSI build won't ever get those feature updates. The next opportunity for the MSI build will be when, if, and ever we come out with a hypothetical Office 2019 or something like that. Then we'll catch it up again, so to speak, and make a new snapshot that has all the functionality in there. So Microsoft really encourages you to deploy the click-to-run version so that we can give you the best possible functionality experience, keep things in sync on the client with what's going on in the server.
And there is an opportunity to also manage up your SCCM too, right?
Right.
I might be getting a little too technical here, but there is the opportunity to manage how they
and you have a year to update, right? An update comes off to click to run, you can delay it up to a year.
Exactly.
Just like with the Windows 10, right? It's that same model.
Yeah.
They always want to keep you up to date. The other thing though is, do you have rights to the MSI as part of Office 365, or is that from an EA?
It depends on how your licensing is set up. So this gets a little messy, but I'll give you the Cliff Notes as much as I can make them. So if you used to have Office licenses with Software Assurance,
right,
and then the way you moved to Office 365 was with what we call a step-up SKU, and you kept your software assurance, then you still have rights to the MSI install. And for large, I'm pointing this side of the room, and maybe that side too. For large organizations, that's typically what we did, right? For customers who never had bought a license, never had an EA, never had software assurance, and the only thing that they have is an Office 365 subscription, then they won't have rights to the MSI. So for very small organizations, it's very likely that what they used to do in the past is they would go out to Best Buy, buy 10 copies of Office 2010. Well, the only thing you have rights to is Office 2010. You can't upgrade that because all you bought was the license for 2010. So the thing that you get with 365 is only the click-to-run version. Does that make sense?
The one thing is I would be consistent across the enterprise. If you're going to do MSI, do MSI for everybody if you're built that way. And if you're going to do click to run, so you all stay.
I agree with you, but I'll give you a but. So I'll say yes, but.
Fair enough.
On the long-term services branch, I think the only build of Office you support is the MSI.
Which you shouldn't be doing considering LTSB anyways, but.
Sorry to get into another technicality, but...
You're only throwing Microsoft at me.
No, for Windows 10, there's what's called the long-term servicing branch, and it's a version of Office that was also a snapshot of the point in time and doesn't get new features added to it. And that's like intended for maybe emergency room situations where you get government, highly secure, like... environments where you need to lock things down, not have any changes.
I don't disconnect.
I think from a support standpoint, the only version of Office that we support to be installed on a long-term servicing branch is the MSI.
Yeah, and so, you know, a lot of our customers are scared of Windows as a service, and so they say, I'm just going to go, I know what I know, so I'm going to go long-term servicing branch, and I would really recommend our customers against doing that.
Yeah.
It should be the
exception rather than the rule, but I just wanted to.
Yep.
For example, our company, we use the MSI, and we're not an LTSB. It's just that we need to control, we have different needs, and certain people can't have that because of legacy software that wouldn't work with the newer version.
Gotcha.
So for us, it was easier to control who got it. Because we also had to
do that for a CCM too.
Well, that's what we used. I don't know what we used our back then, but for us it made sense because we already had that in place for everything else.
Yep.
Yeah.
So for us it made sense now. Again, that's for us.
And
I think that's where you have to kind of look at your own need. But I would certainly say stay consistent. The last year since we started this is when we first started, it was very disparate. SharePoint was. It was all part of Office 365, but they really didn't work together. And every new thing that comes out, Groups is a great example. Initially, it was just kind of a SharePoint-like. Now it's almost a full team. They're really bringing it all together more in from administration, from cross-functionality and integration. So they've done, I think, my kudos to Microsoft for making it a little bit easier and bringing things together better over the last year.
We try.
And I'm usually the critical one in the group, but...
Yeah, and then you can bring up teams and this. But we do our best, and it's even with AX right now, we're bringing together a lot of our Dynamics products all under the same umbrella right now. So for product server automation that's going to be coming together with product online. I don't know if you use those products in the past. A lot of that stuff's all kind of coming together right now.